Coffee is the second most traded commodity in the world. It has dominated the economies, politics, and social structures of entire nations, more often than not leaving a sad saga of repression and poverty for the poor laborers who cultivated on tropical mountainsides. So, how did coffee become so powerful? When he spoke with Steve Paulson, investigative journalist Mark Pendergrast started at the beginning with the legends of the origins of coffee.
My favorite story is of Kaldi the goatherd, who was an Ethiopian goatherd who saw his goats acting very bizarrely on the mountainside one day. They were jumping up on their hind legs and butting each other and acting very strange. So he looked carefully and he noticed that they were eating the berries and the leaves of this tree, rather short tree, that grows wild on the mountainsides there. And it turned out to be coffee, and so the story is that he tried the berries out and the leaves, and he started spouting poetry and running around and feeling all energized, and lo and behold, that was how coffee was discovered. If you ever have seen wild goats in Ethiopia, it's not so wild of a story, and the leaves do contain caffeine. But it was the imams, the Sufi monks, used coffee before anybody else to keep them awake for their midnight prayers.
And coffee did actually originate in Ethiopia, right?
Yes, it did. There's no question that coffee still grows wild in Ethiopia. From there, it made the jump across the Red Sea to Yemen, where they began to cultivate it. So the Arabs were the ones who first used coffee as a trade item. At first, it was taken as sort of a tea made with the leaves or with the dried husk of the berries. Nobody did anything with the seed until probably by accident somebody threw it in a fire and it smelled good and they decided to grind it up and put it with some hot water. That probably occurred sometime in the 1400s.
And Yemen really controlled the world of coffee for a long time, didn't it?
Yes, it did. They deliberately would make the beans infertile before they exported them. They would parboil them or something along those lines because they didn't want anyone else to be able to cultivate them. Eventually, the Dutch smuggled some fertile beans out, and they began to grow coffee in the East Indies, in Java and Ceylon, and they broke the back of the monopoly.
Tell me a little bit about this culture of coffee in the Ottoman Empire when the Turks were occupying Yemen and the position that coffee held in that culture.
Well, the Turks were the ones who really spread coffee all over the Ottoman Empire. And when the first travelers from Western Europe went there, which was in the late 1500s, early 1600s, they brought back reports of this very strange black bitter beverage that these people sat around drinking all day long, which apparently was very good for their health and made them very loquacious, but which tasted terrible as far as they could tell. Eventually, coffee did come to Europe in a big way around 1650, and for the next 50 years, it revolutionized Western Europe's culture, beginning in England, but very quickly taking over in France, Italy, Germany, Austria, and wherever it went, it had a remarkable effect, I would argue, on Western civilization. Up until then, people were drunk a lot of the time. They began breakfast with beer soup and proceeded to drink a lot of alcohol during the rest of their day.
So coffee actually started to replace alcohol at a certain point.
Well, at a very specific point between 1650 and 1700. By 1700, there were 2,000 coffee houses in London alone. It had a remarkable effect, and arguably, you know, a lot of music was composed to the strains of coffee, if you want to put it that way. Bach and Beethoven were addicted to it. The French Revolution and the American Revolution were both planned in coffee houses over coffee. And a lot of business began in coffee houses. Lloyd's of London began in Lloyd's Coffee House.
And yet today, when we think of England, we think of tea, not coffee.
That's true. It's interesting. I think what happened to England is that the coffee houses evolved into private men's clubs. They never did allow women into them. And beginning in the early 1700s, you had public tea gardens that were much more open to women and children. Also, tea is a lot easier to prepare without ruining it. Coffee is more delicate. And finally, you had the British East India Company pushing tea.
Now, we know that centuries ago, the Catholic Church had tremendous influence on all parts of life in Europe. Did the Church have strong feelings about coffee?
Well, at the onset, there were a number of people who felt that the Pope should condemn coffee as a heathen beverage because, you know, here were these evil Arabs drinking it. Reputedly, instead, the Pope drank it and said that, oh, this is so good, we can't let this be called a Satan's drink. We shall bless it and make it Christian. So from the very beginning, it was accepted within Christian circles.
Coffee today, of course, is grown all over the world, and various countries are famous for their coffees, Jamaica, Indonesia, Hawaii, Brazil. How did coffee reach some of these far-flung places?
There was a French lieutenant named Mathieu Duclos who became obsessed with bringing coffee to Martinique. And there's a very dramatic story of him guarding his coffee plant from thieves who ripped off one of the stems of it, and he had to give it half of his water during a drought, and there was a major storm, and pirates came aboard the boat. Finally, he got his precious coffee plant over to Martinique, and he grew it, and it propagated, and it did very well. This is a very romantic story. Unfortunately, what happened in the Caribbean and elsewhere in the New World was that most of the coffee was grown by black slaves who were brought over from Africa. They were already working in the sugar plantations. Now they started working in the coffee plantations. So by 1790, half of the world's coffee was being grown on one small island called San Domingo, which is now called Haiti. And the next year, they rose up in the only major successful slave rebellion in history. And they burned all of the plantations, and they destroyed their economy, which is one of the reasons why Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere today.
So coffee is really central to the history of slavery in this part of the world.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, the Brazilians kept slavery until 1888, strictly because of coffee, making them the last country to ban slavery in this hemisphere.
And now Brazil is one of the major coffee producers in the world.
Yeah, by the late 1800s, Brazil was growing 80% of all the world's coffee. And Brazil is still the world's largest producer of coffee, although certainly not that percentage. Again, let me point out that this was not altogether a good thing. It produced some very, very wealthy plantation owners who had huge spreads built on the back of impoverished first slaves and then other laborers who weren't paid very much, called colonos. Also, because Brazil really relied on what amounted to a monoculture, they stopped growing even subsistence crops. And so when the price of coffee went down, which it did at the beginning of the 20th century, they were faced with a devastating consequence. There was almost a revolution. And what they ended up doing was keeping back part of their harvest, trying to raise the price. What happened in the United States was that we acted as if our birthright was to have very cheap coffee. And throughout American history, whenever the price of coffee has spiked up quickly, there have been government investigations. I can't think of another product, aside from perhaps oil, where that might be the case.
So coffee, in a sense, becomes a tool of foreign policy.
There's no question at all that Americans have become involved in a lot of foreign policy, specifically because of coffee. During the Cold War period, we actually tried to keep the price of coffee up, at least to some sort of reasonable level where people wouldn't completely starve to death. And we didn't do that out of humanitarian concerns. We did it because we were afraid that if the price of coffee went too low, Africa and Asia and Latin America would all go communist. We backed out of that agreement in 1989 when the Cold War was ending. And the price of coffee has been terrible ever since, pretty much.
When did people in the United States actually start drinking coffee? When did it really catch on in this country?
Well, The Boston Tea Party, believe it or not, really did have a lot to do with it. I thought that was a myth when I started doing my research, but I actually found John Adams writing to Abigail saying, I'm going to have to get used to drinking coffee now because it's unpatriotic to drink tea. And that became sort of a patriotic symbol.
And it's always interesting to speculate on why a certain culture gravitates to coffee rather than, say, tea.
Well, it's funny also how a different drink will get a different image. Somebody who drinks coffee is, you know, there's certain American qualities associated with it, so that coffee is for sort of the Wild West and somebody who's strong and aggressive and, you know, really going to go out there and get them. Tea has this image of being more gentle and effete.
Now, for much of the 20th century, coffee was the kind of thing that you'd find in diners. I guess that's where we really associate it, in those free refills of Folgers. And then at some point, it suddenly turned into something very shishi, very gourmet. You went to get your double mocha skim lattes at Starbucks. How did it make that jump from diner to fancy coffee shop?
Well, you have to go back even further and look at exactly what happened and the nature of coffee. Coffee, by its very nature, is a very delicate product that can be ruined almost anywhere along the line. But once you roast it, it begins to go stale within a week or so if you allow oxygen to get to it. So the coffee that we were getting in cans by the time of World War II, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't really very good. It certainly wasn't fresh roasted, fresh ground coffee. Then, after World War II, you began to have instant coffee, along with this craze for everything instant. And because that was so bad, they began to put more and more poor quality Robusta beans not only into the instant coffee, but into the regular blends. I mentioned before that every time the price of coffee goes up, we go crazy in America. Well, that happened in 1950 and in 1954. And we had congressional hearings, but also as a result of that, the major roasters, the Maxwell House and the Folgers, began to put worse and worse coffee in to try to cut costs. And they essentially ruined coffee. By the 70s, when you went and had a cup of coffee, it was weak, it tasted horrible, and it was just something that you had the cheapest way that you could get. And so the time was ripe for a rediscovery of what coffee could really be. And so these little hippie roasters began to pop up in the 60s and 70s, and Starbucks was one of them. Starbucks began in 1971. And they were just basically people who were rediscovering the joys of decent coffee. It turned into what you've just described, which is sort of an effete snobbery where people are paying a whole lot of money for good coffee. But hey, at least we're getting decent coffee now.
Mark Pendergrast is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. He spoke with Steve Paulson.